Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. My name's Paul Henley and we begin in Bolivia in Central South America, where two army leaders have been arrested after soldiers and tanks took up position in front of government buildings in what President Luis Arce called an attempted coup. What happened prompted global condemnation of an attack on democracy. Here's how it started. Video footage showed armoured vehicles and dozens of troops marching down the street in the administrative capital, La Paz. Then suddenly things changed. One of the tanks tried to break down a metal door of the presidential palace. Surrounded by soldiers and by eight tanks, the now dismissed head of the army, General Juan José Zuniga, said the armed forces intended to restructure democracy, to make it a true democracy and not one run by the same few people for 30 to 40 years. Reporters saw soldiers and tanks pulling back from the square shortly after. The uprising lasted about 5 hours. This was the moment the police arrested General Zuniga and took him away in a car. He'd been speaking to reporters outside a military barracks when that happened. President Arce later emerged to praise civilians for standing by him.
They wanted to surprise us and the Bolivian people. We have reacted, and also the people have mobilized against this coup attempt. Thanks to the Bolivian people. Gracias, pueblo boliviano!
Well, I've been speaking to a Bolivian journalist, Madeleine Aguilar Andrade, in La Paz. She writes for the news website La Nube, and I asked her if things were calm on the streets now.
No, things are not calm. Right now, there are some protesting on the streets. We are living an economic crisis. For example, there are no dollars, there's no gasoline or diesel, but we weren't expecting military movements. So it was a surprise for us.
And I understand that General Zuniga claimed, without providing evidence, that the president had asked him to stage the coup.
Yes, that's what he said when he was arrested and transferred to police offices. He gave a declaration to the media saying that it was Luis Arce, the president, who ordered him to move some military vehicles to the center of the city in Murillo Square, because according to what Zuniga said, this will be a critical week for the country.
What's been reaction to that?
The police officer around Zuniga at that moment stopped him from talking. So it seems like if he had the chance, he would say more. After some hours, he was presented, as usually they do that, they present the prisoners. He was presented as a prisoner by the Minister of Government.
And public reaction? Do many people believe what he said?
Yes, actually, even some journalists, we thought that it was attempt of a coup. But after that, the declaration, people start noticing how strange things have been. The image of Luis Arce after this event kind of rise up a little bit. Even people were screaming on the streets, "People is with you, Luis Arce, you're not alone."
But apart from the speed with which pro-presidential supporters arrived on the scene, and apart from the fact that the coup only lasted a few hours, is there any evidence to suggest that it was all faked?
No, there is not evidence. Everything is not pretty clear right now. People are not sure what's going on. So it's not clear what's going on, really.
That was Bolivian journalist Madeleine Aguilar Andrade in La Paz, which is the administrative capital where this happened in Bolivia. Now, Mariala McDonnell Alvarez is Bolivia's ambassador in Geneva. She was speaking to the BBC's Lucy Hockings, who asked her if this coup was orchestrated by the general, if he was told to do it.
We have to have very clear that this was an attempt, a coup d'etat, orchestrated by the general Zuniga. We condemn this attempt of coup. We have wide support from the international community, many of our neighbors in Latin America, maybe many members of the EU, high authorities of the EU also, and also the Secretary General of the United Nations. This was an attempt of coup. We condemn completely. The Bolivian society respect the democracy. The Bolivian society fight for democracy, for stability and for peace in our country.
Ambassador, we are seeing pictures right now, though, of General Zuniga. Apparently, he said to Mr. Arce, "We bring out armoured vehicles," and the president answered him, "Bring them out." That is what he is saying, and that the president has done this to try and boost his popularity and so that he can crack down on the opposition.
Those are lies. We reject those declarations. Of course, how can we believe to a military that violate the constitution, rising up against the government, the legitimate government that was elected by the people in 2020 after a coup d'etat in 2019? We've been taking care of our democracy. We've been fighting for our stability, for making the life of the Bolivian people better after a crisis that it is not just in our country, it's wide in the world. After the pandemic, many countries have suffered many crises, economical, the climate crisis. We're facing these difficulties as developing countries, not just as Bolivia, but we have been doing our best from the government. So we do reject those accusations. I don't imagine a general accepting their guilt. I mean, he wants to give those declarations, I imagine, to not have responsibility. But after that, after he was arrested, we received some information from our officials that he accept that he made a coup. When he was arrested, the first declaration, he accepted that he was attempting the coup.
Ambassador, that is a very important clarification. So thank you for telling us that piece of news. What about human rights activists, though, speaking from Bolivia today, who fear that President Arce is going to use this coup attempt as an excuse, a reason to crack down on his opponents?
No, we don't agree with that. We respect, of course, freedom of expression. We respect the people, but it is not correct. The president has been very clear. We are committed with the democracy. We are committed with the stability. We are doing our best to fight in the global crisis that are affecting the country. We are engaging with that. We keep our policies that goes and respect the human rights. We are going to do again our best to keep the stability. We are very glad that the people unanimous support the government, support the democracy. Even some leaders from the opposition were very clear in supporting the democracy.
And Ambassador, just before we let you go quickly, do you believe this is the end of the unrest in Bolivia, that they will be calm now?
It's a difficult moment, yes, but the situation is under control. As I said, there was a unity in the society, in the Bolivian society, to respect democracy, to support the legitimate government, and now we have all issues under control and we are going back to the normality.
That was Mariela McDonnell Alvarez, who is Bolivia's ambassador in Geneva, speaking to the BBC's Lucy Hockings. To make more sense of this, I'm joined here in the studio by Ana Maria Rura Salazar from BBC Mundo, the BBC's Spanish-speaking service. Welcome to the studio, Ana Maria. Was this really a coup? What's your reading of it?
Well, we cannot confirm any of the versions that we have right now. What we can confirm is that we saw troops on the streets yesterday on the streets of La Paz, Bolivia, that we saw tanks in front of a government building, and that we heard from Zúñiga first a statement saying that he wanted to restructure democracy in the country that is living a very deep political and economic crisis. And I have seen many, many public arrests in the latest months, I would say. And we also know that in a few hours, because this was ongoing for around 5 hours, and was very confusing, very hectic. Many people that we have talked say that they were surprised by what was happening in their country. They really didn't know because it was very fast. And after that, when Zúñiga, the presumably person general leading this attempt of coup d'etat, he was kind of releasing a new version saying that he had a meeting on Sunday with the president, that the president said that was a very critical week and he needed something to boost his credibility and to boost his popularity among this crisis that he's living right now.
So if that
we cannot
had been
confirm
the case,
any of the versions.
If that
right
had been
now.
The case and it had been a fake coup set up to increase confidence in the president, what would be the motive if it all went to plan, the coup failed, there were people on the streets supporting the president, what would be the motive of this general to say, it's all a fake, I was set up? Why would he do that then?
Well, we have to ask him which was behind this. But what we also can say is talk about the context of the relationships that we have behind. For example, Zúñiga, he likes to be called the general of the people. He is a general very, very close, for example, to unions and for workers in mining, very close to MAS, which is the party in power right now. And it's been in power since 2006 when Evo Morales, his founder, the first indigenous president of Bolivia, took power. So he's been very close to this party, and the relationship actually is one of the closest allies or was one of the closest allies of Luis Arce, the president, till Monday. And on Tuesday, he was sacked of his position as a head of the army. Why? Because he was threatening the former president, Evo Morales, from MAS, to go into prison if he decided to run again as a president in the next elections. This is also part of the context, because in August 2025, the Bolivian people has to go to the polls to vote for a new president in Bolivia. So it's a very complicated context right now.
And behind it all, an economic crisis which people are struggling to live through, which it presumably weakens the president, does it?
Yes, we have falling in gas exports, which is the main product of export for Bolivia. And this is affecting also the domestic economy, also the foreign reserves. There is a lack of dollars and this had reduced the fuel imports. So this is producing shortage and domestic price increases, and that have sparked public protest.
Many thanks. Ana Maria Rura Salazar from BBC Mundo. You're with the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. Coming up, the general election is just a week away here in the UK. Not all voters are looking forward to it.
For the past 16 years, the economy hasn't grown particularly fast and people are feeling worse off and they're feeling grumpy at politicians. And I think when people are feeling grumpy, you see some drift off to the fringes, to the right and left, and others just withdraw their vote. And right now, I think a lot of people feel that they're just walking through very heavy mud.
Headlines this hour, Kenyan riot police have used tear gas against small groups of protesters who've returned to the streets of Nairobi. More on that very soon. And the UN has warned that over half the population of Sudan is suffering severe food shortages as the 14 months old conflict there rages on. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour live from the BBC. Anti-government demonstrators have returned to the streets of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, in defiance of warnings by the authorities. The Kenyan police put up roadblocks on streets leading to the presidential palace, as some of those in the crowd vowed to occupy it. In some places, the police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd. Well, the Kenyan president, William Ruto, had already climbed down from proposed tax hikes that sparked a week of demonstrations. At least 23 people have been killed in clashes with the police. The president is facing the most serious crisis of his two-year-old term, as the youth-led protest movement has grown rapidly from online condemnations of tax hikes into mass rallies demanding a political overhaul. Let's speak to Yvonne Mahango, who's an Africa economist with Bloomberg. She joins me now live from Johannesburg. Just explain first, Yvonne, how bad the Kenyan economy is and the problems that people are facing, would you?
So Kenya is experiencing quite a severe cost of living crisis, and that stems from various factors. So firstly, the currency came under significant pressure to depreciate in 2022 and 2023. The currency actually halved in value. So that of course, contributed to inflation increasing quite significantly. In addition, when President Ruto came into office in 2022, he did remove some subsidies, both on the food and transport side, and you saw prices increase on the back of that. In response, you had the central bank hike rates quite aggressively. Interest rates actually remain pretty high in Kenya, despite the fact that inflation has subsequently moderated. So essentially, you've got a country where the currency is much more weaker than it was, say, two, 3 years ago. Inflation remains elevated. Interest rates are particularly high. And you've had this tax burden increase over the past 3 years.
So the government is trying to get a loan from the International Monetary Fund, isn't it? And the problem is that the IMF is demanding austerity measures. What's going on?
So let me provide some context to that question. So following the pandemic, several countries in Africa ended up with pretty high debt to GDP ratios. And that was due to the fact that they had to really step up spending during the pandemic, spend on healthcare and on mitigating measures. So they had to subsequently start bringing down those deficits in order to stabilize debt and avoid defaulting on the debt. And I'm sure you're aware we have two African countries that have defaulted since the pandemic. That's Ghana and Zambia. So the rest of the countries are trying to avoid that fate. And in order to do that, they have to bring down their budget deficits. So these countries, quite a few of them, approach the IMF to assist them with fiscal reforms, and in return, they would get funding. So yes, Kenya is on an IMF-funded program, and part of the targets they do have to achieve is to bring down that budget deficit so that the debt number starts to fall.
So what are the options for the government now amid all this public pressure?
So as you saw yesterday, the president withdrew the finance bill, which contained the proposed tax increases. They now have to go back to the drawing board. What we are anticipating is that they will propose additional expenditure cuts. So instead of leaning on the revenue side through tax increases, we're expecting them to propose austerity measures. The president already alluded to the fact that government itself will have to cut its spending, whether it's on entertainment or travel, but that has to come down in order for them to meet their targets.
And very briefly, what do you think the chances are of quelling the opposition on the streets of Nairobi soon?
It does look as though things remain pretty tense. They don't seem to have been quelled by the withdrawal of the bill. So I do expect the protests to continue. I think it's a reflection of several years of frustration that's just culminated. We'll have to see whether when the final revised bill is published, whether that will quell the protests that we are seeing on the streets.
Yvonne Mahango from Bloomberg in Johannesburg. Now, new evidence has emerged of the compassionate qualities of the first now extinct human species, the Neanderthals. Research into a fossil unearthed in Spain revealed the inner ear of a six-year-old Neanderthal child who had Down syndrome. The implication is that extended family care was needed to keep the infant, who probably had severe disabilities, alive for that long. Penny Spikins is a professor of archaeology of human origins at York University in England. I asked her to what extent she was surprised by this research.
For me, it's not a surprise, but it's really important. So I'm quite excited by this find. I think it's a moving example of the human emotions we share with Neanderthals. We kind of feel for this child, and we have a real sense that he or she lived as happy a life as presumably she could. And I think this find's been rather framed, hasn't it, in terms of, well, were Neanderthals calculating in their care, or were they kind of genuine in the way in which they were looking after people in their groups? We know, for example, that they were looking after adults who were vulnerable. We've got several examples of that. So I think we already know that they were genuine in the way that they felt about members of their group.
In a sense, it's been a perpetuated myth, though, hasn't it, that Neanderthals were grunting, pre-linguistic, not exactly gentle and compassionate. That wasn't their image.
I think you're absolutely right. And there's sort of two things. One is the idea that they might be brutish. And the other is that they might be calculated. And that's a very different thing, isn't it? They might be sort of intellectually working out, well, what benefits me if I look after this person? That's actually a really complicated cognitive thing to do. Neither of those kind of images make sense. The only one that actually makes any sense from an evolutionary perspective is that they genuinely cared.
Let's talk about the detail of the research, because this is the discovery of inner ear abnormalities. Can you explain?
What's been found here was actually from excavations in 1989, and then they've been sort of reassessed and re-looked at. It's a virtually complete inner ear, a fragment of the right temporal bone, and it's got a combination of abnormalities in the tubes in the ear and in the cochlea itself, which are highly typical of individuals with Down syndrome. So that's where the diagnosis, as it were, comes from.
And in this case, they've concluded, have they, that the individual would have suffered from deafness and an inability to maintain balance, so they would need a lot of looking after.
That's very true. They've only been able to interpret the symptoms that come directly from the ear bone itself. But yes, the interpretation is that they will have needed more care than maybe other infants and children did.
And as background to this, give us a brief sense of how the Neanderthals lived, obviously socially.
What I love about Neanderthals, they really push our understanding of ourselves, because they're both so similar in these kind of fundamental human emotions, and yet they really are not the same. So Neanderthals lived in very small social groups. We're not sure, but maybe 13 to 17 people, which were actually very isolated. There's really high levels of inbreeding, very inwardly focused populations. So this is a really different society from what we're used to. But at the same time, there's this fundamental human motivation to care that we see right across the Neanderthal pattern.
That was Penny Spikins, archaeology professor from York University. Don't forget, if you want to listen to NewsHour but miss the live broadcast, there's a podcast of the programme available shortly after we come off air. Updated, of course, twice a day. You can subscribe to the feed as well if you want to get it on a regular basis. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour from the World Service.
Z Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Welcome back to NewsHour. After recent problems with its planes, the aerospace giant Boeing must have been hoping that its forays into space would pass off without incident.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition, and liftoff of Starliner and Atlas V. Carrying two American heroes.
That was the launch of the company's Starliner spacecraft on June the 5th for its first crewed mission on board two American astronauts heading for the International Space Station. Well, the mission was meant to last 8 days. 3 weeks later, the astronauts are still up there, a flight home having been delayed by technical problems. The two astronauts are not in any danger, but Boeing's program was already a year behind schedule. So what's it like when you're stuck in space and things don't go as planned? A question that NewsHour's James Menendez put to the former NASA astronaut Susan Kilrain.
I can talk directly with this because my first mission was cut short. My first space shuttle mission was cut short because of a failure. And there's a lot that goes on in your head about the failure, the time it takes. You have to troubleshoot it. You have to do the procedures. And we ended up having to come home early, which meant a whole bunch of other procedures. But you don't really have time to think about the extra risk involved. And Sonny and Butch, they're both Navy test pilots, as was I. And they're very experienced. This is a test flight of a vehicle. In fact, they actually had to take over and fly manually a little bit as they were docking because of some of the thruster failures. And that's a huge data point for NASA and for Boeing, that that all worked out as planned.
And what happened with Starliner? What has happened with Starliner?
Starliner has had small helium leak from the get-go. In fact, they launched with one. So that was a known issue that they're still trying to troubleshoot. And the helium is used to pressurize the propellant for their thrusters. And so they're still trying to figure out why the leak is there and how to fix it. But it's not of great concern.
And if your return to Earth is delayed, I mean, what does that feel like? Is it just like, great, we've got some more time in space, this is wonderful? Or is it that feeling you get sometimes, and I'm not really comparing it, but, you know, if your flight is delayed from holiday, there is that sort of frustration, there's the uncertainty of not knowing when you're going to get back, and everything feels all a little bit unsettling. Is it like that?
I think it's a combination of the two. For the most part, Sonny and Butch are happy to stay in space. They probably planned for the possibility that they would be there much longer than the day that they had said that was the first opportunity to return, which wasn't really cut in stone or anything. It was just, this was the first opportunity. There's a lot of emotions that go along, but for the most part, they're probably pinching themselves thinking, great, I've got another day in space. I get to look at Earth. I get to do some experiments or whatever it is they're doing.
That was former NASA astronaut Susan Kilrain speaking to my colleague James Menendez. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Now, the BBC has tracked down and confronted a people smuggler assumed responsible for organising a small boat crossing to the UK in April, in which a 7-year-old girl was killed. Our Paris correspondent Andrew Harding was on the beach in France during that initial incident, and in a lengthy investigation, he tracked down the smuggler through Europe to Luxembourg.
Excuse me, sir. Andrew Harding from BBC News.
I'm running through a public square in Luxembourg to confront a man we've been chasing across Europe.
We know who you are. You're a smuggler.
No.
We know he's responsible for putting hundreds of people in small boats heading from France to England.
No, no, where are you?
And responsible for one boat in particular. It was back in April, before dawn, on a beach in northern France. We witnessed police battling with a group of smugglers and chaos as two groups of people charged onto a small boat heading for the UK. Then we saw a girl in a pink coat being carried on board and later disappearing into the scrum. She suffocated soon afterwards. Four others on the boat also died. The girl's name was Sarah, 7 years old, born in Belgium, raised in Sweden. A few days later, still in the French port of Wimmera, we found her father, Ahmed, an Iraqi man, consumed by grief and also by guilt. But what of those who actually organised the family's trip? Not the foot soldiers on the beaches, but the generals working behind the scenes. We hear the man who arranged Sarah's deadly journey is still active, still smuggling. To find him, we have to leave France.
Three sources who've all dealt directly with the same smuggling boss have told us confidentially that we'll find our smuggler in the Belgian city of Antwerp, so that's where we're heading now. Our plan is for one of our team, we're calling him Mahmoud to protect his identity, to pose as a migrant.
So we've parked near the neighbourhood here in Antwerp, which is really where the smugglers gather, and we're going to let you go on foot from here.
Yeah.
We don't want to make any people too suspicious. We know that there is a barber shop there where there is an intermediary or a contact of the smuggler, and you're going to go and meet him, right?
Yeah.
Soon, the trap is set, and many nights later, a breakthrough.
We are now waiting for the smuggler to call us. He's just sent us a text message, so it could be any moment now.
Believing he's talking to a potential client, he offers Mahmoud a seat on his next boat.
You want to get to Britain? Are you ready or not? How many seats do you need? It's safe. 100%.
It is crucial confirmation that the smuggler is still in business. Separately, a source has provided us with more information, pictures of the smuggler and his identity papers. His name is Rebwa, 39 years old, with an Iraqi passport.
So it turns out he's not in Belgium anymore. Worried about being arrested, he's on the run. And we're in pursuit.
Screen grabs and videos sent to us from the smuggler's phone indicate that he's in some sort of camp, which we've matched online to a migrant and asylum seeker reception centre in Luxembourg.
So now we sit and we wait for the smuggler to make an appearance.
Our stakeout at the gates lasts 3 days, but then we get a glimpse of him inside.
Okay, we think this is him.
And a few hours later, we're running to catch him as he leaves the camp.
We know who you are. You're a smuggler.
No.
He insists we have the wrong man.
Who are you?
I swear it, he says.
You're going to call him.
But then we call him on his mobile, the same number he used when he offered to smuggle us to England.
So he's answering the phone. We know that this is you, sir. We know 100% that you are a smuggler, that you are responsible for the death of this seven-year-old, that you put her on a boat, that you took money from her parents, that she and four other people died. That's you. We know this is our man. He's getting on a tram now. We're going to let him go. There's not much more we can do.
So he leaves. And while we don't follow him, we do inform the French authorities, who decline to comment. As for the family Sarah left behind, they're being housed temporarily in a small village in France. Ahmed, has claimed that he had no other option but to hire a smuggler in the first place. True or not, he now says he's learned a hard lesson.
The smugglers only care about money. I hope they'll all be arrested and my daughter's death will not be in vain.
But his other children have no access to school here and no idea what comes next. Rahaf is 12 years old.
What do you miss most?
To have, like, a normal life like everybody.
Do you think you'll have one soon? Where do you think?
In England.
I'm sorry.
There is little chance of that right now. Her sister's body has been buried here in France, but this grieving family has no permission to settle anywhere in Europe. Instead, they wait in limbo while the smuggling industry thrives.
The BBC's Andrew Harding reporting. Now, the leaders, the 27 leaders of the European Union, meet in Brussels today to sign off appointments to the Union's top three jobs. The heads of the Commission, of the Council and of Foreign Policy will be put in post in a behind-the-scenes process that some critics say stretches the definition of democracy. The backdrop to this meeting is imminent parliamentary elections in France, which are seen as a big opportunity for the far right to seize real power for the first time, and some see that as a threat to the way Brussels operates. I've been speaking to a man who for 10 years occupied one of those top EU positions. José Manuel Barroso was president of the European Commission until 2014.
The European Union is a organization of different states. There is no other organization that has such a democratic process. We are not a country. And in fact, it takes in consideration as far as possible the results of the European election. So I was Prime Minister of Portugal and I was elected twice President of the European Commission. Let me tell you, it's probably more difficult to be elected President of the European Commission because we have to go to a vote, a secret vote in the European Parliament. So the European Union, considering that it's a multinational or transnational or supranational organization, yes, I believe there are many mechanisms of accountability.
Let me quote a couple of EU leaders. The Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni slammed the deal. She says she wasn't involved in the negotiations, even though her political group in the European Parliament is now the third largest. The Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban says this is a stitch-up by leftists and liberals. It's undemocratic and it will alienate the far-right parties and might even unite them.
Look, that's another issue. What happens is that Prime Minister Meloni and Prime Minister Orban today, this evening, they will have the opportunity to participate in this election. They can vote against. There is, according to the treaties of the European Union, the selection of these positions are by qualified majority. Now, if you ask my opinion, should it be by consensus? Yes, I think it was a mistake not to involve, for instance, the leader of Italy, because, by the way, it's a very important country. Having said that, from a democratic point of view, it's perfectly democratic, because democracy is the rule of majority, not of minority. Three parties that are, let's say, the core parties of the European Union traditionally. So the PP, center-right, the socialists, the social democrats, center-left, and the liberals, let's call it center, they designated some negotiators to come with a proposal that is going to be discussed this evening in the European Council.
Can we focus on France for a moment? Because some are saying that what's going on politically in France at the moment is key to the future of European democracy and the future of the European Union. Was President Macron right to call a snap election after he had significant losses in recent elections, EU elections?
I don't know if he was right, but he had the right to do it. He can say, as President of France, I have to understand the sentiment of overall French people. And so I think it's important to have the French people to not express what they want for the parliament and for the future.
But what's your opinion? Could France's Rassemblement National, the growing far right, be a threat to Western democracy? Some people say it could.
Too soon to say. I don't like that party, to put it bluntly. Having said that, we have to take in consideration that if they are elected, we have to respect it. And if they respect all the institutions, why not? To be fair, the Rassemblement National, that party, has been in a process of becoming more to the center already. They were before asking to leave France, to leave the European Union, to leave the euro. They no longer speak about that. On the contrary, they say that they will be in the European Union, they will be in the euro. They said just yesterday their candidate to prime minister says that their intention is not going to a war with Brussels, as they said. Now, having said that, of course, it is disruptive. It's a party that has an history and a doctrine that is basically opposed many of the European, if not most of the European policies. So, yes, it's going to be extremely challenging and a concern from a European perspective how to work with France in case there is that majority.
But the rise of the far right in France is surely important from the point of view of the message that it gives to China and Russia. A letter signed by 170 French diplomats said that Moscow and Beijing see this as an enfeeblement of France and an invitation to interference in Europe.
No doubts about it. I'm sure that Mr. Putin will be opening a lot of champagne, maybe French champagne, if the party of Madame Le Pen wins. By the way, in the past, her party was living with a loan of the Russian bank. Having said that, now they are trying to appear more acceptable as a party of power. So it will be quite interesting to see if it happens, the far right comes first, if that will be completely disruptive or not, or if the European Union, once again showing its remarkable resilience, will be able to somehow integrate and moderate those extremes.
Do you look back on your days as president of the European Commission a decade ago as a safer, more stable time? Are you nostalgic?
No, I'm not nostalgic, I can tell you. And it was never safe. It was never. Remember, there was a time of the financial and sovereign debt crisis when many people were predicting the end of the euro. Let's not exaggerate the current problems. They are important challenges, but it's not the first time that we are dealing with these kind of challenges.
José Manuel Barroso there speaking to me shortly before we came on air. He's former president of the European Commission. You're with the BBC World Service and NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour from the BBC. Now, voters go to the polls a week today in Britain's general election. They'll be doing so at a time of record levels of distrust in both politicians and in the political system as a whole. Although a lack of faith in politics is hardly unique to Britain, it does appear to be even worse in the UK than in its European neighbouring countries. Here's our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
Welcome to Hull, a once very prosperous port city in the northeast of England, now more down on its luck, and where in 2019 fewer than 50% of people bothered to vote at the last general election, the lowest turnout anywhere in Britain. I've come to ask people what they think of politics and politicians.
Democracy as it stands is a joke. It's a four-year lottery between two parties. And Parliament is a farce as well. It's like old-fashioned Oxford debating society. It's just not fit for purpose anymore.
I think they're all the most selfish bunch going. Whatever party you vote for, I don't trust any of them.
They're just corrupt. Because they're all wealthy and they don't care about us. We're at the bottom of the pile.
Is there anything that politicians could do to, I don't know, restore your trust and confidence?
Visit the area and try and live a life as a normal person.
So how typical are the residents of Hull in being fed up and disillusioned with politics and politicians? I'm with Sophie Stowers of the UK in a Changing Europe programme at King's College London and author of a recent paper on apathy in Britain and how it compares to other European countries. So, Sophie, how typical is it?
I mean, we know it's very typical. A majority of the public distrust politicians, but also there's also that doubt about just their fundamental ability to do the job. Realistically, our voters just don't think politicians are very good, to be blunt. What's interesting is how that translates into turnout. We know that certain groups are just simply less likely to turn out. So we know that younger voters, people who haven't been to university, people from more deprived backgrounds, ethnic minority voters too, are all less likely to actually turn out in the polls. So even though the apathy is widespread, it only affects turnout for a more specific group of voters.
If there is no doubt about the historic levels of apathy and anger here, who is to blame and what can be done? Charles Walker is standing down at this election after 20 years as a Conservative MP. He's one of those rare politicians in that he is liked and respected across the political spectrum.
Have I made you blush a bit, Charles?
You have. It's not about apportioning blame, though, as to why there are levels of apathy. It's trying to understand why. And I suspect there are high levels of apathy because for the past 16 years, the economy hasn't grown particularly fast, and people are feeling worse off, and they're feeling grumpy at politicians. And I think when people are feeling grumpy, you see some drift off to the fringes, to the right and left, and others just withdraw their vote. And right now, I think a lot of people feel that they're just walking through very heavy mud.
You've been a politician for 20 years. I mean, does this anger, does it sort of bother you? I mean, worry you?
All anger bothers me and worries me, but when people get angry, they look for simple solutions to complex questions. And that's when you get into demagoguery. And as we see in Russia, that doesn't work out so well, does it? And at least we have the right to be apathetic in this country.
But I'm going to give the last word to a young woman I met in Hull. If I say the word politician to you, what's the first thing that comes into your head?
Boring. I have no idea about anything. I'm so clueless about everything. I literally have no idea, like, at all.
Do you mind if I ask you, do you think that's your fault or the politician's fault, can I ask?
Probably mine, because I don't really go out my way to go have a look at what's going on. It's more like TikTok, I see anything. But I literally have no idea who's who, what they stand for, how even to vote, I have no idea.
The current anti-politics mood is obviously particularly bad for the incumbent party, and maybe one of the reasons why the Conservatives seem to be heading for an electoral beating of truly historic proportions. But it also means whoever wins the election will be facing a headwind of scepticism and low trust. So don't expect much cheering or fanfare on July the 5th.
Rob Watson reporting from the city of Hull. Next week he will look at the role the issue of immigration has played in the election campaign. Now, tonight, US time, is when the two candidates in this autumn's presidential elections take to the stage in the first televised debate of 2024. Donald Trump will go head-to-head, of course, with Joe Biden in a rematch of the contest 4 years ago. They stand pretty much neck and neck in the current opinion polls. Let's talk to John Sudworth, the BBC's North America correspondent, joining us live from Atlanta, Georgia, where the event is being hosted. Welcome, John. This is happening earlier than usual, even before the candidates are officially nominated by party conventions. What will they try to achieve at this stage?
Well, just to give you a quick idea of where I am, Paul, I am in the McCamish Pavilion, a short distance from the studio. This is a stadium normally the host to basketball matches, but today it forms the press centre. Looking around, I can see multiple live points, all of the TV lights shining, CNN branding everywhere, in many ways defining the sort of politics of entertainment that has come to make up so much of the political system here. Many people, of course, would say that is part of the problem. And I think tonight you have very much that sense of this being a huge media occasion. The idea that what people are looking for tonight is less about policy and more about style. All focus will be on the demeanour of these two candidates. The big question for President Biden is whether he can allay those concerns over his age. The big question for Donald Trump is whether, in particular, in his attempt to appeal to sort of middle ground, independent, undecided voters, whether he can allay those concerns about his criminal convictions and anti-democratic rhetoric and appear more reasoned and presidential.
Well, you mentioned entertainment value. It seems to stand in the way of that. There'll be no studio audience, and if the candidates' answers are too long, they get their microphones turned off.
Yeah, it's a hugely controlled debate, this, Paul, breaking with previous convention. Each time the candidates are speaking, their opponent's microphone will be turned off. They'll be separated by a distance of about 8 feet, so we don't know whether, if, for example, one of them wants to attempt to interrupt, that might creep onto the live mic some distance away or not. So hard to know how that's going to work, but essentially this is an effort by CNN, the host of this debate, to control the candidates and attempt to avoid what we've seen in previous years, that kind of constant barracking. People will be watching very carefully to see how that works.
Many thanks. We look forward to the event. John Sudworth, the BBC's North America correspondent in Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks for listening to this edition of NewsHour. Join us again soon if you can. Bye-bye for now from the whole team.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.